I don't know about you, but I feel like I can never, ever, no matter what I do, keep up with the endless torrent of email and Facebook, not to mention Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, and all the rest. Well, media theorist Doug Rushkoff says all this technology is actually changing our relationship to time, and we're all having trouble adapting to it. He talked with Steve Paulson.
Doug, the title of your book, Present Shock, is a reference to Alvin Toffler's 1970 book, Future Shock. What's the difference between future shock and present shock?
Well, I guess in some sense, maybe the sensation might be similar. The real difference is that the future that Alvin Toffler was describing that we were moving towards is here with us now. So while Toffler was really warning us really to learn how to orient to a world that was changing ever more rapidly, to basically be able to adjust to change itself. I'm arguing that that change has happened, that if anything, you know, as we passed from the 90s into the 21st century, we became less of a society that was just obsessed with the future and what's next and what's happening, what's the next big thing, where is it all going? And we became a society that was very much in the moment, in a kind of an always-on, real-time, hyper-connected moment. So our focus really becomes less about how do we adjust to change to something much more like how do we adjust to living in a world where everything is happening seemingly at the same time.
Well, you break this idea of presentism down into five big areas, and let's talk about those. One you call digiphrenia. What is this?
Well, digiphrenia is interesting, and it kind of comes out of that video game sensibility. I mean, the beauty of video games is that instead of watching some other character go through a story, you're the one going through the story. You know, you're the one making the choices in real time, and you move from choice to choice to choice to choice rather than watching these canned choices. It's the sense of agency. But, you know, the digital environment very often makes it seem like you don't even have to choose. You don't have to choose between this and that. You can choose both. And we're doing so many things online where we're choosing both that we've ended up with really multiple instances, multiple incarnations of ourselves, kind of running simultaneously on all these different platforms. And it's very hard to live with more than one you. You know, digital technology is great for copying things, but human beings don't copy so well. So there's you on Twitter that maybe somebody's commenting on something that you did. There's you in your inbox that's filling up with messages that are waiting for responses. There's you on Facebook who might be being used to advertise a product you never even heard of while you're asleep, you know, and you'll wake up that you've been in these sponsored stories. You know, so how do you deal with all of these different yous running simultaneously? That's sort of the essence of this digiphrenia or this kind of digital confusion.
So you're basically saying that it's enough to make you a little crazy. There's almost like a split personality here because we're tending to so many different digital personae.
Right. And even if your personality is not split, your digital personalities are split and your single personality is going to have to deal with all of them. I got the idea for the digiphrenia chapter when I was in the lobby of a hotel in Berlin. I kept trying to log into my Google Calendar to see if I could do one talk at the same time as another talk, whether I'd be able to get from one to the other in time. And each place I went, I couldn't log in until I finally got Wi-Fi and I'm in this lobby. And I get this message back from Google that they locked me out of my calendar because they said I was trying to log in from too many places at once, right? So Google Calendar didn't believe I was a human being. They didn't believe one human could be in all those places at once. And that, to me, seemed to be the essence of, you know, the problem we have with digital culture. It's not this idea of information overload, and all these people have all these problems with digital technology. And this, I promise you, Present Shock is not one of these books. It's just whining and hand-wringing about the problems of digitality. But what I do get concerned about is our readiness to really to put our human lives into digital time frames. You know, digital technologies really don't understand time. They live outside time. They're just sequences. You know, your Twitter feed is not in real time. It's just trying to catch up with you. Just because people are sending emails out to you, it doesn't mean that now you have to respond in real time to them, right? The beauty of digital technology was that it waited. You know, the early conversations we used to have on the bulletin boards, we were all so smart because we had all the time in the world to respond to these things. We sounded smarter online than we did in real life.
Right. Well, and the irony, of course, is that this was supposed to make our life better. It was supposed to make it easier, and it seems like it's just made us feel crazier.
Right. And that's because, and I mean, and not to get leftist on you or anything, but I really do believe it's because instead of using digital technology kind of for slack, which is what we saw it as, right? We're all going to be able to work from home in our underwear anytime we want, you know, because we'll just get our work done and turn it in as it's ready, rather than going to work for this 8 hours a day and being always on while you're there. What we ended up doing instead was kind of taking the time is money efficiency values of the industrial age and translating them onto the digital age, where digital technology really, if we're going to embrace it the way I think we can, it's about really liberating ourselves from these obsolete industrial age priorities and embracing a totally different really way of working in a much more peer-to-peer fashion where we create value and sell it directly to one another rather than going in and having these sort of 9-to-5 jobs that are really just a relic of the first factories of the 1300s.
Now, another aspect of this presentism that we've been talking about is what you call overwinding. What do you mean by overwinding?
Yeah, it's funny. I got the idea for overwinding when I was rereading Stuart Brand's great book, The Clock of the Long Now, in order to write this one. What he argues in there is that we need to think in these great sort of 10,000-year time spans.
And this is sort of following up on an actual clock that is being built that will last 10,000 years.
Right. I'll be interested to see if they actually finish the actual clock. I guess there's enough money that went into it. You know, to me, it was just as valuable as a thought experiment, really. What would it be like to build this thing? What would it mean? The most important thing is that now people, he wants us to think in these 10,000-year spans rather than just, you know, next year or even next century. What is the impact of this over 10,000 years? And I was trying to do that, you know, and I had this plastic water bottle. I was about to get on a plane. I didn't see a recycle bin. There was just a trash can there. And I'm like, do I just throw it out? You know, is it going to be 10,000 years? And I realized it wasn't feeling like a long now to me. It was feeling more like a short forever. And that's where I got the idea of overwinding, where in a presentist society and an always-on sort of micro-moment managed society, it's very tempting to try to compress these really long time scales into really short periods of time. So you'll see examples of that, say, you know, on the stock market, where people don't buy in order to invest in the future of a company, they buy in order to make money on the trade, right? So people buy Facebook in the morning and they're mad 5 minutes later that it hasn't gone up and they go sell it. And people who aren't satisfied with that, you know, they end up buying derivatives on stocks, which are really just a way to buy the future stock now, or you buy a derivative on the derivative.
So are there solutions here? I mean, one of the things that you talk about is what you call spring loading. What's that?
Well, spring loading would be a positive way of looking at winding, saying, okay, we can do time compression, but let's do it consciously and willfully rather than just as a way of trying to beat the clock. Or let's at least apply it to areas where timing is necessary. So there's a hospital, you know, it's a hospital in Israel. They wanted to be able to sort of have a hospital in a box that you could just pop on a soccer field somewhere and it would just kind of expand. So what they do is they take a whole lot of time and they put into preparation, you know, okay, what if we're going to have an OBGYN clinic and we're going to have a disease thing and a virus control and something for refugees and starvation? You know, they work out the whole thing and they actually do pop it into these crates and stick it on a cargo plane and they sit and wait. And when the Haiti earthquake happened and when the Japanese tsunami happened, Israel sent over this plane. They popped this thing out on parachutes and the doctors and nurses land on a different plane. And in hours, they have a giant working hospital. You know, the hospital they put in Haiti was better than any local Haiti hospital. And they just dealt with such high volumes of people. And that's really just this sort of a positive way of looking at time, how you can compress something and then explode it out.
Well, it raises questions, fascinating questions, about what we mean by real time.
Mm-hmm.
There was a traditional sense of real time of, you know, it was kind of what we would do with our physical body, you know, not dealing with any kind of digital technologies. And yet, real time has, I think, has taken on an entirely different meaning now.
Oh, it has. Real time means this sort of always on Twitter feed. Oh, that's real time. And of course, that's not real time. That's 5 minutes ago, 10 minutes ago, 10 seconds ago. It's still not you in real time. The Greeks actually understood this way back when, even with the sundial or whatever they had two different words for time. You know, there's the typical one, chronos, which means time of the clock, like it's 4:01. And they had this other word, kairos, which meant timing. And timing was more about your readiness or the appropriateness. Timing was what only humans could really understand. It's like, you know, I crashed the car at 4:01, but what's the best time to tell Dad that I crashed the car? You know, is that 5:01? No, it's timing. You know, that's after he's had his drink and before he's opened the bills, right? It's much more subtle. And that more and more time you spend aware of timing and being ready, the more you begin to connect with all of these cycles that, you know, you could call them new age, but they're actually real. I mean, when you ask me how I work according to the moon. You know, I became aware of Irving Dardik, this Olympic trainer who was getting all these great results by sort of matching people's workout routines to lunar cycles and looking at different weeks of different tides, and it also affects your body's chemistry differently.
Wait, so how do you do this? You work according to the lunar cycle?
Yeah, believe it or not, because what new research is showing, I mean, you can see it in the book or go to, there's a bunch of places like somaspace.org is a great place to look at this stuff, or go to Irving Dardik's Superwave site. So this is edge science, if you will. So it's the kind of thing that, you know, you do a little experimentation on yourself and just see what works and what doesn't. What I found out from them was that over a 28-day lunar cycle, there's sort of four main weeks. 28 days is 4 7-day weeks. And in each week, a different neurotransmitter seems to dominate our brain chemistry. The first week is acetylcholine, the second week is serotonin, third week is dopamine, and the last week is norepinephrine. So if you know that, you go, oh my gosh, it's not just me, but everybody's on acetylcholine this week. That means they're going to have good energy, right? They're going to be peppy. It's going to be great for introducing them to new ideas. Serotonin week, everybody's going to have a lot of energy to work. You know, everybody's going to be very productive. So that's when I do my writing. I don't even worry about it the next week. Dopamine week, you're not going to get anything done dopamine week, that's when you're going to go skiing and party and go nuts, right? And the final week, norepinephrine, that's the fight or flight neurotransmitter. So that's putting everybody in a very sort of analytic, structural, sort of Barack Obama mindset. You know, that's where to organize my calendar. That's when to organize the chapters of my book. So when I did that, I stopped thinking of dopamine week, which did turn out to come up every month, as writer's block. That's not what it is. It's something else. This is the time when I'm going to enjoy people and have my parties and do my crazy stuff. You know, and then when I looked at it that way, you know, and I just did it by my efficiency in terms of words, my word count went up about 40%.
Really?
Yeah, when I worked really according to these sort of underlying biological clocks. And this stuff, which we look at as folklore now, you got to remember, we looked at jet lag as folklore and old wives' tales until it was Major League Baseball managers started to realize their pitchers did way better when they traveled from the East Coast to the West than when they traveled from the West Coast to the East. And it didn't make sense until they really came to understand how biological clocks work, our relationship to our melatonin in the sun. And there's all of these other cycles. That's what keeps people alive and in time. You know, and when we ride roughshod over it, either with, you know, shift work, trying to be always on, trying to have the same responses in the second week of a cycle as the third or the fourth, that we're always the same. I mean, you can push over it if you're a professional. You can do your show every day. But if you become aware of it, you can realize, oh, my shows this week are going to be more like this, and my shows that week are going to be more like that. You can really schedule, you know, your sort of intellectually challenging ones.
You're giving me whole new ideas on how to produce radio here.
It's true. And then put the music stars and those folks on Dopamine Week, you know, and you can play a tune and do all that. It really does work.
Doug Rushkoff is the author of Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. I talked with Steve Paulson.